So I have something that on my mind to talk about, which is very important for me, but I'm not sure I have it formulated in my mind well enough to explain it, but I will try. Maybe it's, you know, very simple. And I think the basic message or point is that in Dharma practice, in Buddhist practice, that we should think of the, you know, if we distinguish between the goal, the means and the goal, we should always remember that the means needs to be in line with the goal or in harmony with the goal. The means and the goal is not necessarily the same thing. Some Buddhists will say they're the same. The means and the goal are the same. Usually in the Theravadan tradition, they're separate. But to think of the means as something that's in harmony with the goal, or aligned with the goal, or reflective of the goal. And what that means is that if you want to be peaceful, which is one of the teachings of the Buddha, he puts a lot of emphasis that those people who have attained the goal, they are people who have become peaceful. And if you want to become such a person, you should be such a person. If you want to become peaceful, be peaceful. If you want to be free, act freely. Begin to overcome your inhibitions or whatever keeps you from being free. And often in some of the earliest strata of Buddhist literature, the ideal person, the kind of the goal of where the practice goes, is mostly defined by changes in the person's character or personality or the way they are in the world, as opposed to some gnosis, some attainment that now they understand something really, they got some, you know, the right understanding of what life is all about. It's a transformation of personality, of character, of being. Very simply, those forces of attachment that are within us, of clinging, of fear, of hate, get released or get transformed, so that generosity, love, become characterize the person more, peace, not being in conflict, being more self-reliant. And so those are kind of the ways in which often that the person is described. And the way to that goal is by living that way. Now, it's not easy to live that way. You know, if the goal is to be peaceful, it's not easy to be peaceful. That's part of the reason why we come to practice, because we're not peaceful. We're in conflict with ourselves and the world around us. So you're not expected to be able to do it just like that, because otherwise the means and the goal would be the same. But if you understand that the means should be in harmony with the goal or reflective of the goal, then where the practice is when you're not peaceful, then can you... that becomes the practice. That becomes the area of exploration of understanding. So, hopefully with a peaceful, compassionate approach, that when you find yourself in conflict with yourself, in all the ways we can be in conflict or conflict with others, we take that on as part of the practice. To look at that, to understand it, to release it if possible, let go of it if possible, or to let go of it in a wise way. There's a wonderful expression that's repeated a lot in the tradition that says the Dharma is good in the beginning, it's good in the middle, and it's good in the end. And I think there's many ways of understanding that, but one of the ways is that it's good in the beginning, it's good in the end, in the middle, because in all three stages, the goal is reflected, is discovered, is revealed. A little bit of peace is really worthwhile. If you first begin your Dharma practice, and you're able to let go of a little bit to have some kind of peace, that is really good. If you can do it kind of medium level, that's really good too. And if you can do it thoroughly, that's really good too. So I'm saying this so we can look at how we engage in our practice as beginners, as, you know, middle level people or whatever, or advanced people. How do we engage in our practice, and is the way in which we're doing the practice isn't somehow in harmony with the goal of what the practice is about? One of the things that the Buddha put tremendous stress on, and this is one of the reasons why I wanted to give this talk, was this kind of what I'm going to try to say next, is he put a lot of emphasis on loving kindness and the importance of being kind, or metta is the word. And he had very strong statements about its importance. And loving kindness is certainly one of the qualities of someone who has attained the goal. They tend to be a kind person. They're motivated by kindness. They have a kind disposition towards others and themselves. They're friendly. But in that the means and the goals needs to be in harmony. The idea you don't wait until you have some great attainment to become kind and friendly, but you practice kindness and friendliness from the very beginning of the path. It's really at the foundation. It's at the beginning, middle, and end. One of the most kind of strongest statements the Buddha had on the importance of loving kindness is a little bit gruesome. I think I told some of you recently this story, but the Buddha said, if a person comes up, he's talking to his monks, so that kind of lightens it a little bit for us. But if one of my monastics is caught by a thug, and the thug ties you down and begins with a big saw, begins severing your limbs, cutting off your arms and your legs. If that monk gives rise to hate while this person is doing it, or anger, that monk is not following my teaching. Instead, what the person should be doing is generating loving kindness. So always coming back to loving kindness. So it isn't just simply that loving kindness is part of the path in the beginning, middle, and end, but it's even, in extremes. Now, I take this story not to be kind of, literally true, exactly, but I take it as being kind of an extreme kind of teaching story that was really emphasizing how important it is not to give in to hate or anger, but rather try to cultivate loving kindness. Now, we all know, of course, we do have hate or anger. I suspect very few of you in this audience is completely free towards a tendency of beginning angry. So that's to be, that happens. So if the means and the goal are supposed to be in harmony, then how you relate to that tendency to anger has to somehow be reflective of that goal of not being in conflict, of being at peace, or being kind. So can you be kind or generous or open or friendly towards these tendencies like hate or anger as it arises within us? So there's a wonderful juxtaposition in Buddhism of putting tremendous emphasis on working on these things, seeing hate and anger, greed, as being not really part of the path, as being something which we should not try to live by. But it could, that kind of ideal could weigh us down. But in practice, if you go to Asia especially, but I think even here in America, there tends to be kind of a lightness among Buddhist practitioners. So rather than taking this as being a heavy teaching to judge us and feel bad about us, it's built into the teaching to have kind of a light attitude towards all this, or peaceful or friendly attitude to what we discover as we engage in the path. So the beginning, middle, and end of the path is characterized then by interest in engaging in the life kindly, compassionately, peacefully, generously, and all these kind of qualities that are found in the attainment of the goal. Now to kind of a little bit switch gears and hopefully bring it all together. Yesterday when I did a one-day sitting on mindfulness of the body, I used the analogy, the comparison of a masseuse, and also an artist. And I say we used masseuse now. A masseuse, massages your body. It's very nice when you get the massage, mostly. The masseuse is there, your body is there, and with their hands, her hands, they're massaging it. And so there's a contact with your body there. Your expectation is, if a person's a good masseuse, is that they bring other qualities besides just putting their hands and kind of moving your hands around your body. That you can kind of feel sometimes when a massage therapist is really present, and you kind of expect that real presence there. That they're bringing quality of presence to that. They're bringing a quality of investigation, of interest, a familiarity with what the human body is like, and an interest in discovering what your body is like. And they're exploring. You really feel they're getting exploring, finding out where the knots are, and really getting to know it. You can perhaps feel the difference between someone who's being harsh with the way they massage you and someone who's being gentle and kind and caring. It's in the way that they're there. There's a lot of qualities of mind that could be present in that masseuse that you would value getting the massage. One of the things is you would hopefully have is that the person has some ability to be concentrated for the hour of the massage, that they're concentrated and present. They bring that quality of concentration to what they're doing. So to take this analogy to the mindfulness practice, our body or our thoughts, our feelings, our experience is like the body of the masseuse is touching. The awareness is like the hands. And a lot of what we do in mindfulness practice is bring our awareness to our experience. But there's more than just awareness that we bring. We don't just bring awareness in contact with experience. There is also a lot of qualities of mind that we are cultivating or developing, either indirectly or directly, to support that mindfulness practice. Just like the masseuse has hopefully developed all these other kind of qualities. And there's a lot of different qualities that the Buddha talked about that go together with development of mindfulness practice and the Buddhist path. And it could be a lot of the same qualities that you would expect out of a good masseuse, you know, that you would expect out of a good meditator. You expect a certain level of presence. Really be present. You're present there for your experience. You're not casual or uninterested. You're really present for it in the same way someone would be present for your body giving a massage. The person is interested. The mind is interested in your experience. So interested in getting to know it better, exploring it, exploring the contours of it, finding out where the knots are, finding out where the looseness is, and kind of getting to know it. There's an interest that goes along with that awareness. There is concentration. The person can not only can be present, but can be there in a concentrated way. There's maybe kindness, development of kindness. You're there in a kind way to the experience. So you're not judging yourself or the experience harshly or bitterly or all these things that we tend to burden ourselves with. And there's maybe a level of joy or delight. It's nice to have a masseuse who enjoys what he or she is doing, right? If a person's not enjoying what they're doing, we probably wouldn't go back. We expect that to be part of it. Even though, you know, overtly, we're just talking about, you know, we don't think about all those qualities, you know, when we first think about massage, but in the background, they're all there. So when we meditate and we're doing mindfulness practice, there's all these qualities of mind that aren't necessarily obviously important. We don't think about them so much, but actually they're very important. And one of the important qualities is a quality of kindness, of friendliness. Can we meet the experience in a friendly way? Can we meet our neighbors in a friendly way, in a kind way? Can we meet our life in a kind way? Are we interested in that? Some people think it's Pollyannish to do that, or they think it's Buddhism light to practice loving kindness and be kind. But I would say that it's maybe it's Buddhism light, it's Buddhism medium, and it's Buddhism heavy. You know, it's the whole, you know, it's the beginning, middle, and end. It's all good. It's all. So I've known people. I'm giving this talk partly because of having met in the past people who are quite serious about the Buddhist path. But the idea of being friendly in all directions hasn't sunk in. Some people don't do it towards themselves. And some people aren't ready to do it towards others. Sometimes people don't do it towards other practitioners because one of the very seemingly inherent, I wish it wasn't, maybe I shouldn't say it this strongly, but almost inherent perhaps, or one of the things that seems to be built into maybe just Buddhist circles, but I think it's almost any religious circles at all, spiritual circles at all, is comparative thinking. Teachers do it. that person teaches that, and what do you think of that person's teachings? And that person's teaching isn't quite as good, or and then that person's experience and this person's experience. I think maybe spiritual people are basically kind of insecure. And so comparative thinking comes, a lot because, they're kind of insecure, so they're looking, to make sure that they're okay. Especially Buddhism, right? Buddhism is kind of an odd religion here in America. It's kind of, a lot of our family don't do it. And they kind of look at us kind of strange. And what in the world are you doing? So it's very, we want to be justified in what we're doing. We want to feel like we're doing the right thing. Who wants to be doing the wrong thing? That is not very good for your self-image, to be doing the wrong thing. So you want to do the right thing. And how do you establish you're doing the right thing? Well, one of the ways we do is we compare ourselves to others. And we make sure that in our mind, they're doing the wrong thing. Then we know that we're doing the right thing. That's part of the function of being judgmental often, is that we, it's often a self-protective mode to be very judgmental of others. If you can establish that they're somehow off, then you know that you're right. And then people get together and they like to, talk about somebody else, the third party, because you're establishing how special you are by saying, well, that person, I don't like this, which is a judgment. I really think it kind of, some of it maybe is, healthy even. Some making distinctions is important, an important part of life. We don't want to not make distinctions. But can be more interested in being, in living the qualities of the path than we are in almost anything else. Can we live the qualities of kindness and friendliness, of compassion, of being peaceful, of being generous, of being wise, of being self-reliant, of being, what are some of the qualities? What are some of the qualities you think should be part of your meditation practice as a support for it, or as a condition of it? Or what do you think? If you're going to fill in the blanks, what do you think are some of the mental qualities that can be part of the beginning, middle, and end of the path?
Patience.
Acceptance.
Being awake.
If you want to become an awake person, start by being awake.
Compassion.
A willingness to let go.
Joy.
It's very beautiful in the Dhammapada, which I translated the last couple of years. There's so many expressions of joy or expectation that if you're engaged in the path, the joy and delight is going to come as part of it. There's one verse that says something like, if you have the habit of loving kindness, and if you actually have it with me, if you have the habit, if one is friendly by habit and is skillful in conduct, then one will have much delight.
Fortune cookie?
Well, you take your wisdom whatever you can find it. I've had some good fortune cookies.
Good qualities. You have to find the balance. And I often struggle with it. Where is the balance?
It's a, yeah, it's a very, very good issue. And I don't know if I have, you know, a good answer for that, but the my understanding of Buddhist teachings are that is that the the kindness, the generosity, the compassion goes in all directions. So, meaning it also includes ourselves. And sometimes there's a tendency for people to focus on being altruistic at the expense of oneself. It's all about being kind to others, and I don't really count. You know, or selfish if I take care of myself. And the idea is to make it but you're just as important as anybody else. The Buddha emphasize that you're just as important as anyone else. If you think of yourself as being less important than someone else, that's a form of conceit that gets in the way of the path. So to include oneself, but to think you're better than others is also a problem. But to be all-encompassing, so what do you need in order to, you know, when is it becoming a burden for you? When is it becoming tiring or exhausting for you to do this? What are your needs in order for your well-being? If you know someone was watching you and wanted you to be happy, they might say, "Oh, wait a minute, Barbara. You know, I think you need to not. You know, you better take the afternoon off. You've been going around, you know, 7 days now, taking care of all the sick people in Palo Alto. I think you need a day off. You know, whatever. You know, you know, some friend would really be interested in you and do that, but to do that for ourselves also, and not depend on other people to kind of give us feedback. So it needs to be, you know, so that including ourselves in the picture, hopefully then we're more discerning about what's appropriate and not appropriate. And then to have a long-term, kind of a little bit long-term understanding of what our needs are too. So it isn't just in the moment, but, you know, what do you need in order to be comfortable, to feel safe in your life? What do you need to be kind of basically taken care of in old age? You know, so you don't want to give all your money away and then end up 10 years from now or 50 years from now, you know, in trouble. So some discernment goes into it. Is that anywhere approach being?
A little bit. If there's still, if you want to stay with money, I could, for instance, live a very, very simple life. And I wouldn't need very much money. Or I could lead a more complicated, a richer life, and more money. Huh? So you still have to find the balance, even though you have enough. There's no enough. There's this level, and the same with helping people.
So, you know, yeah. One of the interesting things that the Buddha would kind of point to, I believe, is what brings you the most delight. And it's possible that for some people, simplicity brings the most delight. And they would actually, for their own sake, not because they feel guilty or feel responsible to pass on their money to other people, but that what brings the most delight is the simplicity of a simple life, and not with a lot of cares and burdens. And a lot of us know, you know, how quickly the things escalate, you know, and you know, with needs, you know, all the things we have to do in order to take care of our lives and our houses and our cars and our, you know, this and that, and you know, it just grows and grows and grows. And maybe some of you just really love doing all those things and find a lot of delight in chores and bills and getting the car oil change and, you know, you know, but some of you maybe would find that there's actually more delight and joy. Life is actually richer by making it simpler. So that's part of the evaluation, you know, what brings you delight and joy? And what is it that motivates the kind of lifestyle anybody lives, all of us live. And my lifestyle is getting more complicated as I get older and various reasons. I used to be a monk. I was very happy. I'm very nostalgic, you know, of how wonderful it was. But one of the reasons my life is getting more complicated is that I have a son now. And it feels to me important for me that I raise him a certain way. That I, you know, it doesn't make sense for me to go back to the monastery with my son and, you know, share this little, you know, 8x8 room with him. And, you know, my wife and, you know, she can't be in the room with me. Maybe she'd be on the porch. I don't know. I'm choosing to let my life get more complicated, and I'm becoming much more sympathetic to How difficult it is. Yes.
I'd like to ask a question about fear. When you were talking about if you were having your arms and legs sawed off, and to not be angry, not be hateful, but what about fear and how you overcome fear? Like if you don't want to be fearful and you're trying to have the goal meet the means, and one of your goals is to not be fearful, how do you not?
Live a fearless. How do you live? Yeah. How do you live a fearless life? So that's one of the goals, to become a fearless person. But we have fear. So there's a number of ways in which we have to be very friendly towards the tendency to be afraid. We have to be interested in and study it. Probably the most kind of the first thing to be said about the issue of fear is we should be interested in it. And kind of stop for it. There's kind of a story from the Buddha's life. Where when he was still not enlightened, when fear would arise, he would basically stop for it and pay attention to it. You know, he took it really seriously. So take our fear really seriously, and learn how to be mindful of fear can take the sting or the power out of the fear. To learn how to hold it in awareness, how to hold it in a kind way, how to feel it in the body, how to understand the cognitive belief systems that go into the fear. And see, maybe they're not true. There's certain levels, certain kinds of fear can go away by simply having a different belief system. For me, very simply, for example, I used to worry a lot about what was going to happen in the future. And then it happened often enough that what was going to happen, what I was afraid was going to happen in the future, no way turned out any kind of way that I imagined it was going to turn out. You know, I had to go do something, you know. And I showed up, and the event was canceled, you know. Oh, that was a lot of wasted worrying. I should have worried about something more productive. So I learned after a while, I don't know what's going to happen. And built into my earlier belief was that I knew what was going to happen, and I was operating as if it was going to happen. And so it actually gave me a little more lightness around my worry when I realized, you know, I don't really know. It's a supposition. So I think I'll not invest so much worry until I've actually had more evidence that it's going to be that way. What? Then it's too late. But that's nice, too. So some of it has to do with our belief system, our beliefs that about us, who we are, what our needs are, our beliefs about what other people are doing towards us and how they relate to us, and to begin investigating these things, the belief systems, also learning how to be mindful of it in a non-discursive way, without analyzing it. It's very powerful to sit with a lot of fear and learn you can sit it out without dying or without being overcome by it. And it gives a person a lot of confidence, and in the future they can go into a situation and they can be afraid, but the fear doesn't have to limit them because they know they have the ability to kind of hold it and contain it. So I'd encourage you to look for opportunities, you know, to study your fear. And one of the great places to do it is in meditation. Don't use your meditation to get rid of the fear, you know, calm out. You know, don't be in a hurry to kind of cool out through the meditation, but by breathing mindfully or whatever way you can do it, turn your attention, actually look directly at the fear and get to know it and see what you can discover, and looking at it, become freer of it.
To me, there are two kinds of fear. There's apprehensive fear that something might happen. Always seems to be extremely useless. There's another kind of fear, and that's immediate fear. The rattlesnake is on the path in front of you. That is, it seems to me, an extremely healthy fear. It's a fear that allows us to navigate the world in a rational, reasonable way. There's a rattlesnake on the path. Step on it, you give it some space and it goes away. But they're two different things.
Right, and I completely agree. At least 90% of the fears that run most people's lives is the apprehensive one, the one about the possibility of something. It has to do with imagination. What might happen? What, you know, It's partly a power of our imagination that most of the fear we expect, we imagine, we're afraid of something is going to happen. But right now, it's actually quite safe. One of the techniques of the therapists work with people who have panic is that, you know, sometimes they'll sit in panic in front of the therapist, and the therapist will say, you know, what's happening right now? And, you know, well, we're sitting in this room, and the sun is shining or whatever, and there's a flower vase there next to me, and there's a rug, and you know, and you're a nice person. And they kind of realize, there's nothing you're actually threatening at this moment. The sense of threat is about a possibility in the future. So 90% at least, probably the percentage is higher, it's not the kind of thing like rattlesnakes. But even when there are rattlesnakes, learning how to be wisely present for fear and how to hold it and be with it can help us avoid a lot of unnecessary secondary reactions around that fear. So we can relate to it in a wise way. So we don't kind of just act out of the fear in an unwise way. We can act wisely. Maybe rattlesnake's not the best example, but... It happens. Actually, thinking of rattlesnakes is, I went out with a few weeks ago with four-year-olds and their parents up to Windy Hill, and we were all kind of exploring, hiking around, and we went off the trail, and there was this big log that had fallen down, and they were looking. One of the moms lifted up the big log and was looking at all the insects underneath, and it was kind of fun for the kids to see that. And then she rolled that big log back, and right there, foot away from where she and this little four-year-old girl were standing, was this little kind of baby rattlesnake. And did she act fast. She picked up that girl and, you know, leaped far out of the way. And that's really good. I mean, that was a good thing to have done. That's good fear, good responses. But then I've known people who have been held up. I've known people who have been held up at gunpoint, and they were afraid, but they stayed calm in the situation because they knew how to stay calm, and they knew how to be afraid in an appropriate way. And I've known people who have been held up at gunpoint and just acted out terribly, you know, and just ended up in jail themselves because of the way they responded to being held up. Very unskillful approach. So. The healthy fear, what are the supporting qualities of mind that go with that? And are there healthy supporting qualities? So one of the themes of today is it's often helpful to look at what are the supportive qualities of the mind that go together with anything? What are the supporting qualities of mind that go together with mindfulness, go together with healthy fear? Sometimes they come and they come that way. They come kind of naturally in the wake of good practice. A lot of qualities will come just in the wake of good practice. And so there's a lot of teachers who don't emphasize, they don't emphasize developing any special qualities except keep focusing your mindfulness and everything else will follow. But it's a little bit idealistic. It doesn't always work that way, partly because not all of us have, you know, pristine, perfect mindfulness practice. There is a lot of emphasis in a tradition of doing specific things to develop the other qualities. I mean, for example, in Asia, there's a lot of chanting. Chanting develops good energy and concentration. It tends to develop gratitude and other kind of feelings, and they're supportive of the path. Sometimes people do specific concentration practice in order to develop the powers of concentration. People do loving kindness practice to develop their powers of loving kindness. People practice generosity to develop the capacity to be generous. People do things that develop self-reliance. It's one thing to go and practice at Spirit Rock, and it's another thing to go practice at Jokoji, the to the little rustic Zen center up on Skyline. There's different qualities that get developed by practicing mindfulness in those two places. At Spirit Rock, it's so comfortable there. You know, it's like state-of-the-art, kind of like the Hilton of retreat centers. And Jokoji is like, you know, it's like, what is it like? It's
rustic.
What?
No star.
No star. Rustic. You know. And two years ago we were there, and we were there for a two-week retreat, and by the third day into the retreat, the water pipes burst for the fresh water, and they couldn't find where they broke because it was all underground. It took a long time to figure out how to fix it, and we went about 10 days without any fresh running water up there. And then we went down to the fire station down Skyline to get fresh water. The caretakers would go there a few times a day and bring these big plastic jugs. But there was no showers for that time. And there was no water for flushing the toilets, except we had a system where we would use dishwashing water we cleaned the dishes with, and we would carry it into the toilet in, with buckets. And then after, you know, when it was really necessary, we would use that water to flush the toilets. And on top of that, it rained during much of the time. It was cold. And, you know, there's very little, you know, and we had a wood-burning stove that kept us kind of warm, but and most people are staying out and they're staying in tents. To practice in that kind of situation requires a certain level of letting go. That you don't have the opportunity to practice at Spirit Rock. So, you know, traditionally, you know, living a life of simplicity and living a life in the woods and being a forest monk and all that developed all kinds of other qualities that then were supportive in turn for a mindfulness practice, being self-reliant, being discerning, being able to kind of figure out how to do things in a useful way, investigation. Sometimes, you know, some of us, this is, you know, I shouldn't say this perhaps, but I'll say it anyway. You know, it's always like, you know, I guess every generation looks back at the golden era, right? When I was young, you know, the golden era, you know, I was young, I you know, had to walk to school, or when I was young, we only had black and white TV, and whatever. And it's all downhill since then. Well, I guess, you know, maybe this is the kind of comparative thinking I was talking against earlier, but for many of the people who practiced in Asia, especially, there's a appreciation of the kind of sacrifice and letting go and that required because of the kind of austere conditions. That when practice occurs in very comfortable conditions, a part of our we're not challenged in the same way, and that challenge that came from being in austere situations, most people found was very helpful. You know, you have to be really serious then. You have to kind of, anyway. So the conditions within which you practice also, you know, develop certain qualities of mind or strengths.
I have a quick question. Slightly different topic, basically. While we are trying to, like, be kind and try to be peaceful with ourselves and with our people around us, are we even remotely justified in expecting others to be kind, not necessarily to us, but among themselves, or express the same kind of kindness and feelings? And if they are not, are we even remotely justified in trying to let them know the importance of being such? Because I've had this problem with my belief that people should be kind, because I'm sitting here with my life very comfortable and everything going, fitting in the perfect place, and I say, yes, I can be kind to people, but for others, the situation could be totally different, and I don't know whether I'm justified in expecting them to react the same way. Mm-hmm. But problem is, if they don't react, and there's some problems between them and some of the others, I kind of feel frustrated and think that maybe my belief system is wrong or something.
I don't know. To me, it seems that it can be dangerous to have too much expectation of what other people should be like, and especially expecting them to be kind. I think the primary focus is not to have a belief system about other people so much, but really feel confident that it's valuable for you to live that way. And they can be as they wish. And you kind of go, you know, they respond to you accordingly. But I think it's, in my mind, I think it's appropriate to expect people to not to be unkind. So I don't know if it's appropriate to expect people to be kind and friendly, but it's appropriate to expect people not to be disrespectful of you or of each other. And if someone is disrespectful of you and actually kind of does something which is clearly disrespectful, a transgression against you, I think then we should speak up and say that this is not how it should be, or this doesn't seem right. Or I think we have it's reasonable to have expectation that at least that people are neutral to each other. You know, not, you know, at least that people are not unkind. But you know, that they go to the opposite and actually do kind things. You know, that's as they wish. Does that make sense?
A little bit, but the thing is, most of I'm not very aware of the Buddhist teachings, but at least I'm a Hindu, so even in those teachings, it's like even if the other person is really unkind to you and like does some bad things to you, you try to be kind and calm and things like that. Exactly right. What you said in terms of chopping off your limbs.
Right.
So how it's for me, it's, it seems to be that it's not necessarily very difficult, but I'm not convinced that that probably is the right way. Or somehow there's some kind of an frustration coming into me saying, why is this thing? Like, why can't I let him know that that's not what he should be doing?
I think if they're being unkind, or if they're being disrespectful, then I think it's quite fine and appropriate to, in depending on the situation, of saying something or doing something. But if they're simply not giving you, not being friendly to you, just in kind of a neutral way, I don't think you say, hey, by the way, I think you should be friendly. You know, I can't imagine kind of expecting someone to be, you know, demanding someone to be friendly. But if they're being unkind, I can say, you know, I can say, that's being unkind. You know, that's not nice. You know, I feel uncomfortable. It hurts me, you know, when you do that. So, I mean, in India, the shining example of someone who's remained, I think, loving and kind and peaceful, I think in most circumstances, but also was very clear about the boundaries of what was appropriate and inappropriate, was Mahatma Gandhi. You know, he was tireless in speaking against the British. And he didn't, you know, he said, well, it's, you know, the British are kind of unkind, and they're kind of doing not nice things here in this country. And I'll just be kind. It's okay. I'll just serve them tea and carry on as you wish. You guys, here's some tea. And he's, you know, he kind of put his foot down, and says you can't do this in his way. So I think there's definitely a place of speaking up when people are unkind, but a lack of kindness, just in and of itself. Yeah.
I think that what's most helpful for me with that is that when I look at somebody being unkind, is that they're suffering in some way. They have to be. You can't be unkind and not be in pain. And so, you know, I try to focus on having compassion for that person.
Oh, we're over. So, I'll be back in a couple of weeks. Thank you.